better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierka with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough. Or even if they don't. Today is April 17th, 2015. This is episode 1559 of the Survival Podcast. And you know what day it is, don't you? It's Friday. That's right, it's Friday. Time for your calls to the Think Line. 866-65-THINK. 866-65-THINK. One more time with all numbers. 866-658-4465. That is the toll-free number that you can call to leave your question or comment for a show like today's. I put about 10 on the air a week. And of the ones that come in that I can actually hear the person on the other end of the line talking, we're probably getting 20 to 30% of the calls online. It's not that huge of a call volume that people make into the Think Line. So it's actually a better chance to get on the air than it is, let's say, with an email for a Monday show. Remember, you can call in questions for expert council members, and the best thing to do if you do that is immediately email me and tell me that you've done that. TSPC in the subject line of any email sent to me makes it a hell of a lot more likely that I'll see your email, especially if it gets gobbled up by one of the many spam filters that I run on Outlook so that, well, that I can actually have a life outside of email. Anyway, with that, before I get to your questions today, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you. Sponsor of the day, number one today, Fortress Defense Consultants. I think that the survival community in general, the prepper community in general, is pretty well versed on firearms. And is pretty pro-Second Amendment, pretty pro-firearm, and has a tendency to own guns. One of the places I think that we have our biggest weakness, though, is that especially those of us that grew up like I did with a gun in your hand. And I really did. I grew up I was way into like the single digits the first time I ever shot. And I was, you know, basically traveling the mountains with a .22, seeing to things like bringing home dinner for the table and plinking and practicing with a .22 when I was 11 years old. There's not a lot of places where boys can do that anymore. But those of us that come from that have a tendency to think of ourselves as being, well, we are proficient enough with firearms to not really need training. But the reality is knocking a squirrel out of a tree and saving somebody's life are two entirely different things with two entirely different modularities of adrenaline through the body. And rather than investing in yet another gun, it makes a lot of sense at least once every couple of years to invest in yourself, the operator of that gun, complete that linchpin of the triangle of efficiency, the weapon, the ammo, and the operator. Best place I know to do that, Fortress Defense Consultants. I have had incredible reports from every single member of this community that's taken training with Frank and his cadre at fortressdefense.com. And remember, they do travel to train. If you can put together a group of, let's say, 6, 10, 12 people, and they'll find a local range and they'll come out and train right where you're at. If you have your own property, they can do that too. And, you know, this is something, go to the places where you have groups of people to get together. What a great thing for a church group to do, to take the men and women of that church and learn to better defend the community that church serves. Just a lot of opportunities for training beyond traveling to Indiana where Frank's school is. Next up today, Jeff, the Berkey guy Gleason. What are you going to get from the Berkey guy? Shocking as it might be, you're going to get Berkey water filtration systems. But at his website, directive21.com, directive21.com, you will find a lot of other really great stuff for your prepping needs. But he is the Berkey guy, and he does specialize in Berkey water filtration systems. I just filled up my Berkey today. It is, you know, the one product that I use every single day of my life, even if I'm not the one filling it up today or filling bottles of water with it. If, you know, Dorothy's doing that today, I guarantee I'm drinking water. Right now, that's been through it. Right now, I'm drinking coffee, and I can tell you the coffee that we make always has water out of the Berkey. Why? It tastes better. We get great results. It's one of the best investments we've made. It was a gift that I gave to my son and his fiance at Christmas time. We bought them one. I wanted them to have it. I wanted my grandson drinking the best water possible. And I turn personally to Berkey for that. And when I need anything for my Berkey or need a Berkey for a gift to someone else, I go to the Berkey guy. I'm not going to go to the non-Berkey guy. I'm going to go to the best dealer that I know of. Jeff, the Berkey Guy, Gleason, you should too. Directive21.com. Remember, Fortress Defense, the Berkey Guy, and many of our other sponsors do offer deals for members of the Support Brigade. You can learn more by going to thesurvivalpodcast.com and clicking on members. And if you're already a member, log in and click on benefits to see the discounts that are available to you. If you want to help support this show and you want to get great discounts to great providers for services and products you're probably buying anyway, please do consider joining the Member Support Brigade. Again, you can do that just by going to thesurvivalpodcast.com and clicking on members or the MSB banner there. You can support the show at about 18.3 cents an episode. Military, law enforcement, Peace Corps, active duty, and prior service, and first responders like EMTs, paramedics, and firefighters all qualify for a discount. If you email me before, not after you join, TSPC service discount in the subject line, one or two sentences about your service. Anyway, let us look at the year that was the episode so we can get into your awesome calls. I have today, for the year 1559, from Alex Shrugged at tspwiki.com, scientists discover sex scientifically. We have Teresa of Alvila meets the choir invisible and lives. We have a hurricane hits Pensacola County. Pensacola Colony. There is a Pensacola County, though, by the way. Same place this colony was. Anyway, I'm going to do the hurricane one because it's a natural disaster, and I think there's something to be learned from it on multiple levels. King Philip II of Spain has decided to expand colonization of what will one day become the southern states of the United States. He has appointed a man named De Luna to lead the expedition to colonize what will be Pensacola, Florida. However, due to the problem with Indians in previous colonization attempts, De Luna leaves his ships anchored off the shore and does some exploring first. That exploring will last 2 months. Remember when Spaniards were hit by a storm and washed up on Galveston Shore? This time a massive hurricane hits De Luna's ships while they are fully loaded with equipment, supplies, and colonists. Most of them go right to the bottom. The survivors will carry on, but the handwriting is on the wall. The colony will fail. My take by Alex Shrugged. There's something to be said about being too cautious. De Luna didn't want to get caught out by the Indians or French raiders, but he was so cautious as to be foolish. Regarding hurricanes, modern-day people don't realize how wonderful satellite pictures are. Despite the many failed predictions of the paths of hurricanes, the weather scientists are saving thousands of lives simply by publishing the pictures. Without satellite systems, there is insufficient warning for any meaningful evacuation of the coast. And calling weather reports a prediction is misleading. Weather scientists can certainly say something intelligent about a storm as to what it might do, but they are not making predictions as if they have a crystal ball. This is nature, and at some level, it is unpredictable. I completely agree. I have quite a few different places I can go with this. One is the Native Americans of Florida. The Seminoles are the most well-known, but there were many tribes in Florida, and I'd like to tell you about one of them and the type of thing that a colonist in the southern United States might have run up against once the natives decided these guys weren't good for us and wanted to fight back. A little further north of what we're talking about today, primarily centered around the St. John's River and the area that we now call Jacksonville, Florida, Duval County, was a tribe called the Timucu. And let me give you a little rundown on these guys when they were dealing with somebody they considered to be an enemy. The braves of the tribe would grow their fingernails somewhat long and sharpen them into points, and they would use them as weapons in battle. Over time, they would actually thicken from this treatment and become quite substantial weapons. Clubs were often infused with things like oyster shells, which would slash a man apart. Whenever they prayed into their spirit gods and through their shamanic faith, they would pray for things like the rain and peace and good things, and what would always be included at the end would be death to their enemies. They were actually really a peaceful people, but they didn't tolerate bullshit. And this guy's overcaution certainly was a problem, but I think that one of the things we lose sight of, especially in this part of the United States, is the threat the Native Americans represented once they realized the threat that we represented. These were not unsophisticated people when it came to the art of warfare, especially early on during the colonial periods. Their numbers were far superior. They knew the territory better. They could survive when we would die. And the weaponry of the time was only so effective when you had significant superior numbers on the other side. And, well, they rapidly picked up and learned how to use our weaponry and things like our horses. And that became a big thing for the middle United States tribes that were really in a bad way until they got the horse. But the Floridian Native American tribes were, man, these guys were no joke. And the swamps of Florida and the wilderness of Florida is not understood by most people. I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida. That's why I know this. I, as a kid, would go to certain places along the St. John's where friends and I would actually find significant collections of broken pieces of Native American pottery and other artifacts that were pretty easy to find even back in the 1980s. The amount that we were able to find is just a bunch of kids running around on the banks of the river was indicative of the size of the settlements there and the significant threat that they would represent. Again, I don't want to put it out like, you know, the bad Indians and the good colonists, because that's not the narrative at all. But generally speaking, most of the native tribes of the Americas, from all the way down to Patagonia and all the way up into the Inuit in the north, were way over welcoming of outsiders. That there were some that were immediately suspicious, and they were probably a little smarter, but they welcomed us in. And but once we kind of revealed our hand, what we were up to, many of them fought back, and there's a significant thing to be learned there on many levels that I'll leave to you today. The other thing that I'll point out, though, is that I completely agree with Alex about hurricanes and the threat they represent and how valuable it is to know there is a hurricane, first of all. Not just a storm, not just winds are picking up, it's a friggin' hurricane. And we think it's going to go this way and it could go that way. Okay, that's fine and all, but at least we know it's a hurricane and we know kind of like how big of a hurricane it is and how fast it's moving and wherever it does hit, how long it's going to take to get through there. That's huge. But the reality is a lot of the lives lost today to hurricanes are far more due to our modern lifestyle than in the past. If you lived off the land in the swamps and you understood things like here's a storm, let's go inland, and there was there was still potential for some of these really catastrophic storms to take a lot of life. But in a lot of places where a storm today is a complete disaster, it was in some levels just an inconvenience for the people that were there, depending on where they were in relation to the impact. There are parts of major storms where it's not that the wind is blowing, it's what it's blowing, like trees and people. So I don't want to underplay that. I just want to say that we have a lot more to lose today and a lot more ways that we can get killed or put into a bad way than the tribal peoples of this this place, who simply knew where and when to take shelter whenever something seemed to miss. And we may want to learn from that as well. And that can be done with some pretty smart design things that I've seen talked about in, frankly, the permaculture space. Maybe one day we'll talk about that. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and get into your calls today. Again, the phone number to make a call for next week's show, because this week's already happened if you're listening to it now, 866-65-THINK. And with that, let's take the first call.
Hey, Jack. This is Donovan from Portland, Oregon. Just a quick thought, and maybe interested in what you think. It seems as though a lot of people in permaculture neglect the importance of annuals. It seems like perennials, while very important, it's not really, can't have a balanced diet, or it's harder to have a balanced diet on perennials. And, you know, annuals can reseed and become almost like perennials. So you have a lot of biannuals. I just don't hear too much about annuals. It seems, though, that that's kind of an unexplored avenue. I know a lot of permaculturists have annual gardens and do annual farming, but don't really talk about it as much within their permaculture design. I'm just curious about your thoughts on that. Thanks, Jack. Love everything you do.
I think you answered your own question. Annuals fit right into a permaculture design based on the goals of the designer. As to why we don't talk about them as much, because, well, there's not a lot to talk about. You put in beds, you plant your stuff, and you harvest it. It's well known. It's understood. If you go down through residential neighborhoods, every, you know, 15th person has a basic annual garden. It's almost like asking, why don't architects talk more about floors, even though they put them in buildings? Well, because the floor is a basic thing. It goes into the design, and it's done, and then it gets built. I think that's part of it. I think the other thing is there's a lot more work to be done with perennials than annuals. Annuals have been cultivated by us for so long, and they're so well known and so well understood that finding a different variety of pepper or tomato is as easy as going to the store. There's a, you know, right now, if you go down to your garden stores, there are 40 or 50 varieties of tomatoes available to you if you go to three or four different stores. From brand new super duper hybrids to very old heirlooms. I saw yesterday at a Walmart, German Johnson tomato, right? So, I mean, that's about as old as it gets. So I just think it's understood implicitly that this is an annual and this is how it works. I also completely disagree with a balanced diet being difficult to obtain through perennials. I completely disagree with that. You give me an annual, I'll give you a perennial analog as far as the nutritional makeup. I also think that more and more of us permaculturists have simply abandoned the concept of annual gardens with the exception of maybe having a few small beds, because we can do a huge majority of our annual cultivation right in our perennial systems. So I now have lettuce coming up all over the dadgone property. Mostly black-seeded Simpson, but some romaines and what have you, just by leaving it do whatever it's going to do. And I'd probably have more if the ducks didn't eat it so quickly when it pops up. So I think that it's more along the lines of it's not a delineation between annuals and perennials. I think it's just you're putting systems in, and then you grow whatever you want. It also is the case that the perennial systems that we install take more effort to establish, but less effort to maintain. So that means there's a lot more work to doing it. I mean, if I want to do a garden, I prepare a bed, I throw seeds in it, they grow. And the advantages of annuals are their rapid production. So I can produce, you know, harvestable lettuce in 28 to 30 days. There's really not a perennial crop that I can even get close to a 30-day harvest period. I can produce most annuals in 90 days or less. A few of them run 100, 110, 120 days, longer stuff like some of the squashes and corns and stuff like that. But in general, it's a 90-day or less proposition from sowing to harvest. So they have an incredible value there. But they also require constant replanting, constant upkeep, constant maintenance, unless you get naturalized annuals that self-reseed. And that's really the goal of most permaculturists. We'll do things like seed large amounts of radish and turnip and other tubers and let it go. And what makes it, and what doesn't, doesn't. And we may not have anywhere near the harvest the first or second year that you would if you cultivated that. But 4 or 5 years down the line, you've got these really highly adapted plants that you haven't, you know, adapted by going out and selecting this and selecting that and whatever. You let nature do the work. You just keep throwing seed down every year. I've got naturalized cowpea all over this property that's just starting to show up again right now. I've got naturalized jute mallow, which is a great vegetable, basically, a great leaf crop. And the thing with the jute mallow is long after it's too hot here for lettuce to do well or other leaf crops to do well, it's still fine. It's fine right up until fall when it starts to yellow. So, you know, I also think it also is highly dependent upon the landform that you're in. I mean, if you're in the northeastern United States, growing a tomato is so easy. You can pretty much throw a tomato on the ground in the fall and tomatoes will grow in the spring. If you're in the alkaline black prairie flats of north central Texas, it takes a lot more attention to get annuals to do well here, or you're constructing significant structures as far as beds go, you're having to provide irrigation, so it makes more sense to invest in annual or perennial production. But the other thing is, most, not all, but most permaculturists are very aware that a complete system is only really going to function at its highest order when we include animals in the system. And as soon as I move to animal yields, whether it's, you know, milk and dairy or eggs or protein or a combination of all of the above, then my goals for the landscape become to feed the animals more even than the person. and that is best done through perennial pasture management and perennial mass drop. So I can build a much more sophisticated system that's far more sustainable if I focus on the perennials and let the annuals be more of a byproduct. And I think that's why you see that from permaculturists more. And we're much more concerned with putting in a food forest than we are with an annual garden. Not because the annual garden's not useful, well, because there's 500 books on how to put a garden in. They're all pretty much the same. You know, irrigate, good soil, compost, mulch, plant seeds, harvest. It's so, as you become more and more sophisticated as a permaculturist, the annuals become so much more of a, just an expectation that they'll be there, that you don't really focus on it. So it doesn't mean that they're not there, they're not paid attention to, they're not planted. I mean, I've got jalapenos this year already that are 18 inches tall with peppers on them in my little annual garden bed. I've got lettuce out the ass over there that I didn't even plant. I even threw some potatoes in this year. I grow Jerusalem artichokes in one of my little food forests. And, you know, they produce me, you know, 3 or 4 5-gallon bucket loads of tubers out of, you know, a 10-foot by 4-foot bed. And I don't plant it. And it is an annual, but yet it is a self-propagating annual. So I think there's plenty of room for annuals in the system. I have, you know, this week, I'm waiting for my grapes to get in, so I'm not disturbing what I've already done, but I have 4 huge packets of butternut squash that are going to go in the fence line where the grapes and the blackberries are going, but I'm not going to go put in a bed to put in these squash. You know, the seeds are so cheap. I can plant, you know, 200 plants, and if 120 of them die, I don't care. And frankly, if 180 of 200 of them die, I don't care, because 20 plants will give me more squash than I can use. And plenty of it's storable. So I think it's more about integrating the annuals into the system rather than thinking about it in a bed type scenario. Though, if you have a lot of people to feed, especially in the first 5 years, annuals excel at that. So you design the system based on the needs and the desires of the person. And I can come into a suburban landscape and put in a perennial-based system that will require probably more work in the first 2 to 3 years than annual gardens. But over the lifetime of the system will produce far outproduce an annual-based system and require far less maintenance. So I was actually talking about this with Nicholas Bertner last night. Maintenance might not be the right word to talk about with a permaculture system when done right. It's more of establishment labor that's intensive in a permaculture system that goes to very light maintenance long-term once the system's established. And you just don't do that with annuals in the way that we generally talk about planting them. So if you look at most permaculture designs and you look at when people spec out plantings, you see tons of annuals in them. I don't know. It's just something I think that's largely a misconception and simply not a reality. And I think it's largely driven by people who insist that permaculture is perennials. And most of them are not permaculturists. I've talked to a lot of different people that are in the industry, especially the prepper industry, that say things like, yeah, well, you know, with permaculture, you plant your trees and all, but it's the garden that, okay, you just right there, bore, I'm bored, because you're now discussing something with me that you don't know anything about, because that's not what permaculture is. Permaculture is not even about growing plants. It's about systems design. We can design the system to do whatever we want. Let's take another one.
Hey, Jack. Scott from North Georgia. Got what might be a fun conflicted or prepper scenario for you. Given a 299-day situation, would you continue to broadcast? And if so, how? Or if you'd like to give us your thoughts on what you'd do in general, that might be fun too. Thanks for the show, and hope you can have fun with this thought experiment.
Let me start out with something that I think people need to get their head around. When I look at the storyline of 299 days... I see it being a very realistic problem. And I see a lot of the things that happen from a crime, from a rebellious streak, from martial law, all of that in the book to be very possible. Not necessarily probable, but very possible, very realistic. Where it eventually goes to with militias and wars and all the stuff that's in all prepper novels, I think we've largely gone to the world of not gonna happen. Great reading, interesting fiction, love Glenn Tate. He's a personal friend of mine. One of the few people out there that know who he really is. And I no disrespect to the storyline and where it eventually ends up, but this whole like new American Revolution militia type idea where you're gonna have armored columns marching against each other, this is just preposterous. This is not gonna happen. And part of it is because most people won't do it, won't risk enough for liberty anymore. And the other part of it is you're just not gonna stand toe to toe with the United States military that way. No, they're not all going to turn into Oath Keepers overnight and side with the good guys. So the scenario itself that many preppers keep playing this frickin' Red Dawn movie over and over in their head is not, never, ever coming. Start living your life based on frickin' reality. Okay? I hear all the time, they're getting ready for martial law. You don't get ready for martial law. You don't like, there's this crap going around now. If Alex Jones could be a bigger piece of shit, he now is. Where the National Guard walked in a road march. And if anybody that's ever served and looked at this road march knows exactly what it is. And it's, they're training for martial law. They're slowly, incrementally building up to it. You don't build up to martial law. It's not there one day and you do it the next. That's how it works. That's actually the only way that it's effective. And some of you, the most concerned over martial law, when somebody starts burning your city down, you'll beg for it. And guess what? You'll get it. And it won't be all perfect, and it won't be all wonderful, and it won't be all good guys stopping bad guys. There'll be abuses, etc. But in the end, that's how the state works. And we have the largest, most oppressive military, if it's turned on anything that's ever existed. There is no citizen militia that's going to stand up to the United States military. The only thing you have going for you is that all of those guys in there, not all of them, but most of them really believe in what they do. And it isn't that they'll come over to the other side. It's that if they were pushed to do certain things, I just think they won't do it. They just won't. I'm not doing that. I mean, I really do. That, I think, is the salvation of a civilian military, which is what we have. Now, so that doesn't answer the crux of the question, but it's very important to me that people start getting this through their thick-ass skulls. I don't care what brought you to preparedness. If it's that, you need to let go of the false narrative. If we have breakdowns in this country, it's going to be very much like Ferguson. Okay? And it's not going to be everywhere all at the same time. It's not going to be a bunch of filling camps filled up with patriots being lobotomized and reprogrammed or whatever else you come up with. So the scenario itself is not realistic into where it leads to. Economic failings in this country will simply be pasted back together with the phony baloney bullshit that they were put together with in the first place. And I'm not saying it'll be great. This is the problem. Whenever I say this, people are like, oh, he doesn't realize how bad it's going to be. No, you don't realize how bad what I'm saying can be because you've embraced a Hollywood viewpoint that does not, will not, and is not going to exist. And it's never the way any empire has ever really looked when it's fallen apart. Okay, so let's table that for a second, and now we can answer the question from a standpoint of the shit is the fan, will I continue to broadcast? Unless I'm dead, or I have no way to access the internet, as long as I have backup power, yes. Because that's what I do. The important thing about that is that's what most people will do if the shit hits the fan. They will continue to do what they do for as long as they can, as long as it works for them. Now, if I believe that there is, I'm wrong, and they're going to have this full-scale warfare, and if I broadcast, they're going to put a freaking Patriot missile through my roof or something like that, well, then I'm probably not going to do that, because I'm not stupid, you know, but I'm not going to be down in a bunker, you know, using a couple Pringles cans to upload the show either. So if there was a meltdown, if there were riots in Fort Worth and Dallas, And if there were widespread riots, if we had something akin to the Rodney King riots going on in 50 cities, the economy's in a downturn beyond anything that any living person has ever seen. People are losing jobs. People are, you know, turning cars over. We're having this level of civil disobedience go on. And the country seems like it's falling apart at its seams. But there's not a mob outside that I need to see to. Am I going to keep doing what I do? You bet your ass I am. And how am I going to do it? The same way I always do. They cut down the phone lines. You can't, as long as I can get a signal with a cell phone, I can upload an MP3 file. I can get by. The shows might not be an hour and a half long, but I would use whatever means I have available to me to continue to do what I do, because it's the best thing we can all do when the country starts falling apart. Is to keep, and this is why we should be building lifestyles now that are based on our own individual sovereignty and independence and not dependent on other people. Now, on the other side of that, I'm dependent on all of you people. If you guys don't love what I do and don't support what I do, this is not financially viable any longer. So then the question would be, well, what about, if everything goes to shit and then you're not making enough money doing this? Well, if I'm making any, I'm making some. And I also, at this point, feel like a lot of what I have is because of this audience supporting me. And for as long as I could, I almost see that like as a repayment of debt. Like, I would be here to help you through that time, because I believe that time would come to an end and we would come back into something approaching normalcy. See, I'm not afraid of the Hollywood scenarios of breakdown. That's not what scares me, because I know breakdown won't look like that, okay, in its entirety. And I'm not afraid of, like, the pocket of it being here and ending up dead, because we're all finite beings and we can all die. And I've done my best to make sure I can look after myself if something like that happens. So I can't sit around and worry about that. What actually concerns me the greatest is the plans of the power elite working sufficiently to advance what they're looking to accomplish without disaster, or to forestall disaster long enough to get away with it. I'm more worried about the fact that every single American out there has a dossier being built on them by the NSA and the government as a whole, than I am that, you know, Social Security checks might bounce. I believe that this concept that the economy will fall apart is valid and invalid at the same time. And it's way too complicated for me to go into today. I don't believe you're going to see the day where, like, everything's good today and everything's bad tomorrow. I believe you're watching the economy destroy itself slowly in front of you. It's like a black hole. It's like going over the event horizon and being stretched out into a thin wire, the 1/100th of the width of a human hair. It sucks. But when it starts, you don't even know what's happening yet. And I think that's where we are, the erosion of the middle class. And the reality, though, is the human species is dramatically adaptable. The big fear is how many people are incapable of doing anything anymore. Right? It's that segment of society that has the most to lose in all of this. And it's that segment of society that potentially can become the biggest threat to people who are still being productive. And it's that dichotomy that might be used to institute a martial law that many of the people that seem to so fear it would probably cheer when it happened. It wouldn't be good, but it's not necessarily evil. It is. It's the natural result. Because I'm going to put it to you this way. Those of you that have this, you know, this, whatever your false narrative is, that, you know, the troops will either kill everybody or they won't fire on American citizens. If you were part of the National Guard, Army Reserves, active duty military, civilian militia, whatever you are, and you are part of a group that's pledged to protect your community, and people are killing people, people are setting buildings on fire, people are stealing, people are turning cars over, would you use force to stop those people? See, we have this weird thing in the prepper mind that the rebellious are the good guys simply because they're rebellious. And then we prepare to fight them at the same time. I think there's a lot of twisted logic in the prepper space. And I think that it manifests itself in, you know, with 299 Days being one of the best series ever written on the concept of a breakdown, it still ends up in that spot. It would be interesting for me to see an author take on the coming crises, plural, without it going there. Or without it going there the way that it always seems to go in these books. I think that would be much more interesting. I've probably pissed off Glenn Tate now, but oh well. My opinion's pretty much been the same for the last 8 years. Let's take another one.
Hey, Jack. I'm curious if you have any inputs on storing basic preparedness items in a home where the number one sort of natural disaster risk would potentially lead to the partial or total collapse of that home. So I had heard you mention that you like to store water in those Arizona iced tea bottles, and then I think you said you have a lot of them in the closet. And I'm just curious, in a situation like that, I live in an earthquake-prone area. Should we spread things out around the house in case one part of it is inaccessible? And, yeah, I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on keeping things consolidated versus spreading them around. And thanks for the show and everything you do. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I probably need to do what I did this week and occasionally go back and do more back-to-basics type shows with some of the preparedness stuff. I've just put so many episodes on this stuff out there that sometimes I don't realize that maybe it's been 6 months since I really got into it for not just an episode, but a series of episodes that ties it all together. First of all, yeah, you never put all your preparedness items in a place. If you went through my home on some levels, you might think, is this really a prepper's home? Because there's no giant stockpile. And that's because the items are all over the place. Now, there's a fundamental reality to preparedness. You cannot and will not be prepared for everything. And most people that try end up spending so much money and resources trying to do it for something that's the least likely to occur that they would have been better off building a substantial life for themselves than putting everything into that bunker in Wyoming. I'm just saying. But we do definitely have preparedness items not only in the house, but in our outbuildings. I have lost something that used to bring me a lot of feeling of security that I don't have anymore. That's I used to own two properties. And the second property was very well prepared, at least from a standpoint of, you know, comfort and furnishings and food and backup energy and backup water. And if we had a complete catastrophic loss of one, you could just go to the other one. It was a bug out location in the truest sense. It wasn't to hide from the blue beret Illuminati or whatever. It was to go if you lost your home. Because there is a certain reality to the following. Things like completely catastrophic floods, significant storms, fire and earthquake all have the potential to completely destroy your home. If there is good news, here's what it is. These things never destroy countries. They never destroy entire states. They are not the catastrophic loss of full infrastructure that something like a major economic recession represents or a pandemic represents, right? A real, not the phony one that we have every 2 or 3 years where the news media hypes some bullshit's going to kill you, whether it's because, you know, Johnny didn't get a vaccination for measles and now you're all going to die, or Ebola's going to get you even though it doesn't work that way or whatever, or the swine flu and every other congressman comes out and says to sneeze in your sleeve and wash your hands and like you needed them to tell you that. No matter what it is, like there's a real potential pandemic. These are things that shut down a nation. These are things that shut down a whole state. So the only upside to these catastrophic losses is as long as you can get by or get out, there's usually some system of support that you can depend on. The reason we're going to still make sure we prepare with all of the things that we talk about of basic preparedness anyway is there's a huge potential The house across the street could be flat to the ground, and yours could still be standing or partially standing. You can't think of the standpoint of, well, if I prepare and then the house collapses, I'll lose everything. Well, you have a job, and you could lose that tomorrow. You have a car, and you could lose that tomorrow. And that type of loss can be also helped with simple things like good quality insurance. If you live in a flood zone or have potential flooding, don't just have basic property insurance. Make sure you have flood insurance. Or make sure the insurance you have covers flood, etc. But then the other thing is that there is a big advantage to storing things off-site and creating redundancies. So, for instance, all my data that I have on my computer is backed up to off-site servers, so that if I lost the computer, I don't lose all the data. And the more you can do that with your emergency preparedness items, the better. So one of the things you can think about is talking to a family member who lives in a different dwelling, who's at least open to basic preparedness, and keeping some items there, 3 or 4 days worth of change of clothing, some basic food, some cash, what have you, and having a plan of where to go. You're never going to be able to say, I have everything in place, and no matter what happens, everything will be okay, because tomorrow a gravel truck might run you over. There is a balance that has to be met between a preparedness mindset and a fatalistic mindset. I've done what I can, and what I can't do for now, and what is will be, and I'll remember always that my reaction and my choices and my decisions are more important than any of the stuff that I have. So yeah, I have a bunch of water. Okay, if the house is collapsed in a tornado, it's not there anymore. It's blown away with the rest of the house. Trust me, that's not what I'm going to be worried about at that moment. If a tornado takes up my house, and I'm alive and my wife's alive, and neither one of us are laying in intensive care, I'm going to start putting my life back together, and I'm not going to be worried about whether or not I have a bottle of water. The bottle of water isn't for a tornado. But as crazy as it sounds, there's a tremendous possibility the house could be ripped asunder, the outbuildings could be tore apart, and there's still going to be some of all these different places we have water stored, water available. I have a photo I published years ago of a church that had like a wreck building that was like a metal building, like steel, easy to tear apart by the tornado. And a tornado tore it apart, and there's still pictures on the wall. So even in complete catastrophic losses, there's a potential that many of the preparedness items that you have are still accessible and available. If you have a basement, it makes sense to put some of your stuff in your basement, because if there's a storm that tears the house down, that stuff's probably still okay. But it also makes some sense to put some of the stuff upstairs, because if there's a flood, the basement's what floods. All you can do is the best you can do with what you have. And it makes sense to think redundancy. If you want to be really prepared, get yourself a small RV, stock it up with everything you need for at least 2 weeks, get a cheap place to store it that's at least 20 miles from your home, and put it there. The odds that both of them will be destroyed by the same disaster are pretty low. And if nothing else, you could either use your vehicle that's still serviceable or get somebody else's, go get it and bring it to your property and live in it. Right? And that's why it would make sense to spend the storage fee for a small RV off-site. And here's the thing. I have the financial resources to where I could do that, but I've invested them differently because of my assessment of my risk and my risk tolerance. We all have to make that decision for ourselves. So hopefully that helps you think about that and figure out how to work that out for yourself. There are ways to store things like water. It's pretty easy to put in a small root cellar and sell water and food and stuff below grade. And that's going to be, you know, except for flooding. And then that's why you store things above grade. And if you do that, and you ever have a disaster that takes everything out, again, you're probably going to be more concerned with filing an insurance claim at that point than you are with whether or not your bottles of water are still there. And the other thing is mental alertness and situational awareness. Many of these types of disasters do not just show up. As Alex said, the fact that we have pictures of hurricanes today before they get where they're going saves a lot of lives. So keep the situational awareness up. Let's take another one.
Hi, Jack. This is Dakota from Northern California. I'm just calling to say thank you. We've never met you in person. Thanks to you as a mentor over the last 2 years via the Survival Podcast. At 22 years old, I've been able to provide for my wife, son, and daughter what we've always needed and most wanted. I currently hold 2 jobs, and I'm now starting to build my own business. Thanks to your mentorship, you've given me everything that I need and confidence in myself, which I never had growing up. I'm sure that there's others out there that you've inspired the same way, and you can never know how much that means to us.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that, and thank you for being an example. I want to kind of first say in response to this, if you're someone out there who's making excuses about not getting shit done in your life, about how hard it is, how does that make you feel? The fact that this young man at 22 is supporting a family, working 2 jobs, starting his own business, and getting shit done at 22. And I'm sure you'll say, well, it's easier when you're younger, and I think some things are easier when you're younger, and some things are a hell of a lot easier when you're older. But either way, you don't get any more time than you have, so follow this young man's example and get shit done. This is also the kind of person, and this is important that I kind of explain this, that I meet that will often say something like, well, you changed my life. And the first thing I'll say is, no, you changed your life. I might have inspired you. I might have shown you a way. I might have opened up your mind to something. But in the end, it's an individual decision. And the proof of that is there's people that listen to this show that listen to it purely for the purpose of intellectual masturbation. They want to hear about it. They want to fantasize about it. But they don't do shit, and they're never going to. Fortunately, I think that's a very small percentage of the people in the audience. There's also a percentage that hate me, and they listen because they hate me, and that's a weird demographic to have, but I think all people in any form of talk radio or entertainment have, like, people that pay attention because they don't like you. And that's also a pretty small percentage. Then there's this gradient of everything in between, and there's people that hear this stuff and just decide, you know what, I'm going to go get you done. And then there's people that slowly phase their way into it. Whatever works for you, works for you. But in the end, the point in time where a person flips the switch for themselves is all about that person. It's not about the person that's mentored them or the person that's demonstrated. That person just happened to be the catalyst or one of the catalysts that enabled that person to see what was always there. And it makes me think of something that doesn't really seem that related. But when I moved to Texas, I was just out of the Army. I was 21 years old, and I actually joined the Army at 17. So I had done about 3 years of military service at that point and just turned 21. And the first job I could find, I worked in a warehouse packing boxes, and it was a pretty brutal job, and it was just over minimum wage. And I would pack about $9,000 in merchandise a day. This is low dollar stuff for a company called Home Interiors and Gifts. And the quota was right around $10,000. And I would always be right at quota or a little tiny bit under it, a little tiny bit over it. And like the guy that was the guy, the packer that everybody wanted to be as good as was this guy named Nate. And Nate would pack about $18,000 in average merchandise a day. That's significantly more. It's almost double. And one day they sent Nate to come help me, right? And this is what Nate did. He came over. He said, well, you know how to label the boxes and put tape on them, right? I'm like, well, I've been doing this for 2 months. He goes, okay, you just do that. Try to keep up. 21, arrogant. Yeah. Okay, well, in that scenario, this guy could move a hell of a lot faster because he didn't have to tape the boxes, stack the boxes, label the boxes. All he had to do was package them and make sure they were closable and ready for the tape. And this was like this weird tape that had this wet thing going on and all that had to be done. And the labels had to be filled out, put, stacked, and set up for the guy that would come with a dolly to put them on trucks. So about 10 minutes into this, I'm just getting my ass kicked. And all I'm doing is closing the boxes and slapping on the labels and stacking the boxes. And this guy's like a machine. And this goes on for about an hour. And we end up realizing that we do the calculations because there's a running checker that's checking every item to make sure it's all packed right. That if we had continued to do this for a full day, that we would probably have done somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe $30,000 worth of merchandise. We were moving faster than either of us could as a single component. And this is like a training exercise. And, of course, so then Nate goes back to his table and starts packing on his own again. I never did less than $14,000 in an individual day, unless it was a short day where they sent us home early because we were out of stuff after that. He didn't tell me how to do anything. He just did it in front of me. And one of the supervisors told me, we do that with everybody. It doesn't work for everybody, but it works for some. And you'll never worry about quota again. You've got it now. You'll be fine. Now, I didn't have to worry about quota because I wasn't going to stay in that dead-end-ass job very long, where sadly probably Nate retired from, because he was just that kind of, like, that was, he was good at that, but that was like his deal, right? That was his maximum level of competency, and I had no illusions about getting a, you know, 50-cent raise and sticking around for another year and hoping for another one. But it was interesting that mentality was so easily transferable. And it's because I wanted to do better, even though I was leaving, even though I saw this as a dead-end job. If I was going to be there, I wanted to do the best that I could at what I was doing, so I wanted it. And the people that hear what we talk about on the air, if you don't go out the next day and start kicking ass and taking names, there's nothing wrong with that, because we have this huge variety of stuff that we talk about here. And it might be that you listen for months and then you hear something and go, that's my thing. But the people that find it, and don't just look for it here, right? This is an example, and go look for your thing wherever you could find it. But the people that make the decision and say, I'm going to do this for me and mine, do it because above all, they want it. And they want it greater than the sacrifice required. So I want a lot of things, but when I look at the sacrifice, I want less than the sacrifice represents. But the things that I do really want, I'm willing to sacrifice to get them. I was talking to Nicholas Bertner, as I mentioned earlier, with regard to a different situation. Grant Schultz, and I can't remember the guy that was with him, but they were two young guys out of Permaculture Voices that did a presentation on how to get a farm. If you want to own land, have a couple hundred acres, plant 20,000 trees, run cattle, run sheep, run chicken, like, here's how you do it. And one of them built a tiny house and lived in it for 2 years, and one of them, their wife sewed a yurt, and they cut poles on the property, and they put up a yurt, and they lived in a yurt for 2 years. Both of them eventually built homes. And you can see there were a lot of young people in the audience who had been saying stuff like, I just want to get access to land and whatever, that when they, you could see them beginning to cringe. Ooh, I don't know that I, and what Grant said is, you either want it or you don't. I'm absolutely sure there were young people and maybe older people in that audience who right now are figuring out how to do the same type of thing. They wanted it at a higher level than the sacrifice represented. If you want something in life, you have to decide, what are you willing to do to get it? And what are you not willing to do? And just like buying a house where you have a budget, you'll realize you can have as much as you want within that budget. And then you figure out, where do I put it? And someone else being willing to sacrifice more to get what they want doesn't mean that you're wrong or you're inferior, but it does mean that you then need to set your expectations based on what you're willing to do and the path you're willing to walk to get there. But in the end, get on a path and get shit done, because if a 22-year-old kid can do it, so can you. So can you. And I hope to hear more stories like this, because I know they're out there. I really do. And I wish you the best, young man, and don't give up. And if the first thing you try in a business doesn't work, you're in good company, because the first few things I tried in business didn't work either. But when you keep at it, you find what will work for you. And when you're willing to sacrifice for the good of others, it's funny, but at some point, you almost feel like you're leaving them behind. And then you turn around and you feel like someone pushing you from behind and helping you go forward. And the people that you thought you were, you know, not really paying enough attention to, not really taking care of, are the ones that are giving you the greatest boost to get where you want to go. That's what good family does for each other. My wife had a lot of struggles over the years with how much work I did. But she tells me every day now, thank you for putting out so much effort so that we can have a life like we do. And it's very hard for the people that love you to understand how hard you work when you really want to make something happen. But in the end, if the intention is noble and the execution is valid, when you get where you're going, it's seen for what it really is. It's a sacrifice so that others can benefit. And there is no thing we can do in our lives that will give us greater reward than that. And what it is you build a life for others and you end up with one you love for yourself. Because it is okay to focus on you along the way. And for every person that's ever said something to me like, it must be easier, it must be nice, my response as far as to this show and the community around it is, I never once saw you bumping into my ass at 3 a.m. when I started this thing, and that was the time that I had to work. That's what it took. If you want it, you can do it too. And maybe not the way I did, but you can do what you're good at. You can find your place, but you have to do it, and no one will do it for you, and no one will give it to you. People can give you a hand up or a help or inspiration along the way, but in the end, you're going to have to do it for yourself. Good on you, young man. Keep it up. Never look back. Never look back, except when you're looking back at those that are helping you get where you're going, that are shoving you forward as you charge head into life. And everyone out there that says you can't, you have no excuse. Let's take another one.
Hi, Jack. Jim in New York. I was in a recent debate about the minimum wage, and I brought up the fact that the Fed has been systematically devaluing the dollar. And part of the debate was that the weak dollar is actually good because it will make American exports more attractive and promote growth, which will lead to more jobs, and that inflation is the lowest rate, so that's good too. I wasn't sure how to respond to that, and if you can clarify it, I appreciate it. Thanks. Thanks for all you do. Thanks. Bye.
You know, there's a couple things at play here. One is an example how a little piece of true information held in the mind of someone and having it disconnected from all of the other information that goes along with it can make a person, to the uninformed, sound intelligent but actually be really dumb in what they're pointing out. Number two, the disconnect between your statement and the response. So you're talking about minimum wage and the Fed devaluing the dollar, and that has its own way of playing out. And this person brings up something out of left field. Well, it's good to have a weak dollar because it spurs exports and it makes more jobs for us as an export economy. Well, let's talk about the first side, which is where you were probably headed with this before the objection came, which is if the dollar is weakened through inflation, and we raise the minimum wage, and therefore we create a minimum expectation of income, the necessities of life will eventually equalize to where the minimum wage will become the same value that it always was. So that we could turn the minimum wage from $7.50 or whatever the hell it is to $15 an hour tomorrow. We could do it. There'll be a lot of lost jobs and things like that, but everything will balance out in the end, and you can't run business with nobody there. So sooner or later, you'll get a rebound, and it'll look really great for a bit, and then the next thing you know, a person making $15 an hour will have the same basic lifestyle as a person that was making $7.50 just a few years ago. Inflation will equalize the situation. So raising the minimum wage does nothing to improve the life of those on minimum wage for any length of time whatsoever because of the laws of economics, the velocity of money, and the way fractional reserve banking works. That's completely true, and that's totally independent of a weak dollar argument for exports. Okay? It completely independent. The two are not related. They're not related because we have what's called absolute and relative currency strength. So, and we have what we would call local currency strength and international currency strength. Those two aren't related to each other in the minimum wage argument. They're absolutely connected in many other ways economically. But when it comes to minimum wage, if I made the minimum wage $20 an hour tomorrow, what do you think the rent on a shitty apartment would be in 3 years? What? This is why rich people pay a lot of money for stupid shit. The more money you have, the more you're willing to spend, and therefore the higher prices of the commodities that are sold to you relative to the cost of creating them. Of course, if you change the minimum wage, the cost of the creation of the commodity adjusts. So this is dumb. They're not related. Now let's talk about the actual objection. A weak dollar is good for the United States economy because it will improve our export market. What are we making? Where are we exporting it to? And what is their currency strength relative to the United States dollar? I mean, if the argument itself was just the silver bullet to the people that parrot it, that heard it on TV, think that it was, this country should be exporting the shit out of stuff to Europe and the United Kingdom right now. Because our dollar is weak compared to the euro and the pound. Significantly. Right? And we shouldn't be exporting jack diddly crap to Mexico because our dollar is strong compared to the peso. Yet we export items to both countries and people pay what they think something is worth. Now, you can build an export economy on a significantly weakened currency if that is the role and the goal of your nation for a time. You can look to China and see how they do that. They peg their currency to the dollar with a specific spread. They do not allow it to float in the open forex markets. And therefore, they maintain a strategic weakness against the dollar because their number one avenue for exportation is the United States of America. So to use the weak currency to build a national economy, not just create prosperous niches and verticals in the economy, then you need to have a major exportation partner to capitalize on the differential with. Okay? We don't have that. We're the wealthiest country in the world. The wealthiest countries in the world are never going to be highly exportational economies. They will always be highly importational economies. So not only are the two disjointed and not really related to each other, the truth in the statement is not based on the reality of the totality of the national economy. There is no place where the United States becomes a major exportation nation in the consumer goods market ever again in our current paradigm. And no economic policy, no changes to minimum wage will ever make that happen. And there is no way in which increasing the minimum wage makes that happen. If anything, what it does is increase the cost of U.S.-produced merchandise and items and manufactured goods, and therefore actually adversely affects the exportation market until such time as the economy equalizes and the currency once again devalues itself. In other words, the only way that we preserve the exportation market that we have in regard to minimum wage is through the fact that we actually do weaken the dollar. So one causes the problem that the other supposedly solves. But we're not done yet, okay? Because if we look at what does the United States export? What do we sell to other countries? We don't sell thermoses to other countries. We don't sell plastic hokey things. We don't sell consumer goods at all. We hardly make any more, but we damn sure don't export them. What do we export? We export things like software products. We export things like entertainment. We export things like cars. We export things like jet aircraft. Okay? None of the people with the jobs in those sectors make minimum wage at all. United States software programmers don't make minimum wage. Okay? The people that build cars in the United States, even in right-to-work places that are building them for Toyota, don't make minimum wage. People that build aircraft and do design work for Boeing don't make minimum wage. People that drive the truck to put the fuel in the other truck that carries the parts across the Boeing campus don't make minimum wage. The freaking janitor at Lockheed Martin in Grand Prairie, where they build the shit that we export, like planes and weaponry that we sell to people that we claim to be enemies, doesn't make minimum wage. None of the people in the United States of America that make minimum wage are in the sectors that actually export anything. So the person you're talking to is not technically wrong, but in totality, they're completely wrong. Yes, we can make an argument in certain verticals, in certain niches, that a weak dollar enhanced trading opportunities with partners with stronger currencies. And you can listen to that on stupid things on Fox News or MSNBC or, you know, whatever else their news talking head bullshit Bloomberg you want to listen to. And it's not wrong, but the person hearing it and repeating it doesn't understand what it means. It means that a company that builds specialized computer hardware in Silicon Valley that pays people far more than minimum wage, that has a specialized hardware product that does something for industrial automation, has an easier time selling that product to Sweden. And it's true. And it doesn't have jack diddly shit, never will, with minimum wage. Because if we jacked up minimum wage to where you made the money the guy that builds that hardware makes, what do you think he's going to make? Do you think just all of a sudden everybody will have the same lifestyle? This is a nonsensical bullshit argument that bears no resemblance to reality because it ignores the difference between your currency strength within your borders and your currency strength in relation to the items outside of your borders and who your trading partners are and what you're trading with them. So this is an example of the truth making a person with only a piece of the truth sound intelligent to the unknowing, but look like a complete moron to anybody that knows the total picture. There you go. Good call. I liked that question because it gave me an opportunity to explain things that most morons never will understand. But I think most of the people in this audience go, oh, that makes sense. I get it now. And this is what most of your memes on Facebook about minimum wage are based on. They take a partial truth and they use it to create a fictitious resemblance to reality. The best way to fix the United States economy, well, one of the best ways to fix the United States economy, is the abolishment of minimum wage. Do you know how many people get minimum wage because it is minimum wage? For every person that would be paid less than minimum wage without a minimum wage, two would probably be paid more. Because companies would have to actually negotiate a price. And I'll tell you what, there's people that are working for minimum wage that are worth far more than minimum wage. And there's people that are working for minimum wage, when you look at what they actually provide to the person paying them, they're not worth that. They're not worth minimum wage. And what minimum wage does is it ruins the opportunities that exist for a person that says, I'll work for $2 an hour for a week to prove I'm good, just to get on the payroll. After that, you don't want me, I'll leave. So all it does is it ruins entry-level opportunities. Well, people can't make a living on minimum wage. You're not supposed to. And you will never, ever, 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 ever have a society with a minimum wage where the minimum wage will produce a middle class at the minimum wage. It doesn't work that way. That would mean that the person that's completely inexperienced, incompetent, and an idiot but can show up with their clothes on and not get in a fight is entitled to the same rewards as a person that's competent and does a really good job in the same level of employment. And it's just not supposed to work that way. And all minimum wages is another attempt by a socialist government to make that happen. Let's take another one.
Hey, Jack. This is Brad in South Carolina. Tracker 111 on the forums. I have an expert counsel question for Mr. Stephen Harris. Mr. Harris, what is the best way to keep my smartphone charged and fully operational while on extended backpacking and canoe trips as long as 2 weeks? I'm a scoutmaster and also do a lot of extended backcountry hunts and canoe trips. I use my smartphone for all the hundreds of pounds of books and other equipment it replaces and updating parents when signal becomes available. But keeping it charged has always been a problem. Mobile battery banks of golf cart batteries are obviously not an option 3 days from the trailhead. My current phone is a Droid Max, which has a 3,500 milliamp hour non-replaceable battery, and the normal field use will last about a day if I don't use the GPS and turn it off at night. I've tried several things that haven't worked, like a Brunton Ember 2800, and also a Railvac device that uses AA batteries. I used 16 AA batteries in 2 days. I've looked at the products from Goal Zero, but the marketing around them seems kind of gimmicky. And I also looked at the Brunton Hydrogen Reactor, which seems like a very, very expensive gimmick. Weight and space is at a premium, and I would estimate that I would need about 52,500 milliamp hours, enough for one charge a day, plus one extra charge just in case. Or the ability to reliably generate and store about 4,000 milliamps a day in a way that doesn't consume a lot of time, because I don't want to spend my entire backpacking trip charging my stuff. What is the best route for me to take? Thank you.
All right, so that's the only expert panel question we have this week. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Stephen Harris to answer that one now, and I'll be back with the rest of the show today.
Bradley, this is Steve Harris with the expert panel calling in to answer your question. I want to let everyone know that I've had an excellent conversation with Bradley over the last week and that I asked him to call in this question because the answers that he and I evolved and bantered back and forth were so well developed that I wanted to be able to share them with all of you. First, I want to confirm what Bradley said in his recording, that Goal Zero is gimmick trash. Stay the hell away from all Goal Zero products, especially Goal Zero solar products. They are a sucker trap for you. What I'm going to give you here is stuff you can take straight to the bank and you can use, and you know how it will work for you and when it will work for you and why it will work for you. Bradley, your Motorola Droid is famous for having a real 2-day battery in it. It's 3,500 milliamp hours when most other smartphones are well under 2,000 milliamp hours. That includes the Galaxy S4, S5, S6, and the iPhones 5s and 6. The 6 Plus has a bigger battery in it because it's a much bigger phone. So if you are hiking and the battery is dying on you on one day, then you have a different problem going on. First, for all those of you listening, turn off your Wi-Fi when out in the woods. Wi-Fi eats up a great deal of power. Make sure Bluetooth is off as well and GPS is off. I know, Bradley, you said you turn GPS on because you use it for some navigation purposes on your hike, and you already told me you turn it off when that's not needed. That is fine. Now, what all of you need to know is what most people do not realize is that when a modern cell phone is out of range of a cell tower, it's like one of Jack's little ducklings going, cheep, 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 looking for mama. The cell phone sits there and keeps on sending out pings and crying out, trying to find the cell tower to answer it and to make a connection. This eats up a lot of power, more than you realize, and it's what is making your 2-day battery into a 1-day battery. So everyone, when you're not using your smartphone to make or receive calls or texts, and you need to save your battery because it's a disaster or you're in the woods or whatever, put your phone into airplane flight mode. This will save the battery dramatically. This will turn off all of the radios, the Wi-Fi radio, the Bluetooth radio, and the cell phone radio in the cell phone. It will significantly conserve your power. If you know you won't need your cell phone for a few hours, then turn it off. Now, while turning off and on a smartphone might take a minute or two going back and forth between flight mode and cell phone mode, excuse me, only takes a few seconds, and it's very convenient. Also, you said that you like to enjoy some Kindle reading time on your phone at night when you're on the trail. Turn down the brightness on the phone to as low as you can stand, and this will help save the batteries as well. Kindle books are a heck of a lot lighter than real books, aren't they? As Bradley has already estimated, he needs over 53,000 milliamp hours of stored power to charge his cell phone when he's out on a 2-week trip on the trail. He is many miles from the trailhead and cannot charge his phone from his car. He's out in the woods with his, on his own with the scouts. Bradley will not be putting his cell phone in flight mode. Sorry, Bradley was not putting his cell phone in flight mode, and now he will be. So that will save a good hunk of the 53,000 milliamp hours needed. What I suggested he do is get a total of 2 of the 20,000 milliamp hour lime fuel batteries that cost only $30 each and are at prep1234.com, PREP1234.com. For a previous answer that I've already done for TSP, the battery is already up on prep1234, and you can go up there and you can see it. I did the answer for the guy who was traveling to Ireland with 6 of his relatives. Fabulous battery. Myself and my friends all have them, and we love them. These batteries are awesome. I own them, and they're very much Harris approved. These will charge Bradley's phone between 5 and 7 times each per battery. And I told him to get 2 of them. Now, 2 of them is only 40,000 milliampere hours total. He estimated 53,000 needed. This might be a bit too little for him, and I'd rather have him have more power needed than less power. So what I told him to do, since he's out for 2 weeks at a time, is to get a 14-watt USB solar panel from Amazon. And yes, you're hearing Steve Harris recommending a solar panel with several caveats. I have the solar panel I suggested for him up on prep1234.com. What I wanted him to do was to charge up one battery pack back at his tent at camp while he was on the trail and he had the other battery with him on the trail, and then swap them out every day, rotate the batteries. One day out on battery one, charging battery two. Next day out on battery two while charging battery one. The batteries only weigh 15 ounces each, so they're not too heavy. Since the batteries were so large and 2 of them could almost meet all of his needs, if there was a few cloudy days, rainy days, or days when he was on the march underneath the canopy of the trees, who wants to walk in the sunshine, or days where he didn't have the sun, then he'd have the extra battery power for his phone, and the solar would just give him that much more energy. But he's still not dependent upon having solar energy. Just dependent on having that much more energy. But like I said, he's not dependent on having solar every day. He just needs 3 to 7 days of sunshine, and he'll be fine. He's not reliant on solar. He's augmented by it. I think that sums up Stephen Harris' philosophy on solar very well. Do not be dependent on it. Be augmented by it. Bradley actually chose to get 3 of the $30 20,000 milliamp hour lime fuel batteries so he could do an entire trip on just battery alone with no solar. Some of his trips are all walking or all canoeing, and he's not able to have a tent camp in the same location at night. He's also getting the 14-watt solar panel, so when he does have the tent camp for a few days, he can let his battery charge up at camp while he's out and about. For those of you listening, the photograph of people walking around with solar panels dropped down over their backpack is stupid, stupid, stupid. This assumes you're going to be walking in the sunshine, not underneath the canopy of the trees. Assumes you're going to be walking north all the time for the south-facing sun. This is a stupid marketing photo and not real life. In the reality of walking in the shade of the woods and walking in different directions, this does not work. You also need a significant portion of sunshine during the day for the panel to be effective and not just an hour or so. This is a damn solar panel, not a friggin' lightsaber. We did talk about Bradley getting a 28-watt solar panel, also on Prep 1234, but we decided it was too big and heavy and that the 14-watt with the 2 batteries would do the job. Key words, we found out what would do the job and not be overkill. Most of you are shocked. Yes, Steve Harris recommended a real solar panel for a person. He had a real specific need for it. I don't hate solar. I hate what solar does to most people with a false sense of security. Oh, I have this little solar thing. I can charge my phone. I'm fine. In reality, the solar gimmick they bought is too small, and even if it was big enough, it wouldn't work because you have cloudy days in your lifetime. And what good is it to charge your phone for 5 years when you only have a week of food and water? Money for solar is better spent on food and water and other needs and other tools to keep you alive for more than 1 month. Until you have 2 months of food, water, and fuel stored, don't even consider solar. Listen to what Jack says about your priorities of home prep. The man is 100% on the money. Bradley, thank you for the excellent question and excellent conversation. I think it was a true contribution to the extra panel Q&A. I look forward to hearing a report from you on how good this worked out for you over your next two-week hike. Okay, guys, call in some more questions. Even if they are about solar, I will take care of you, I promise. This is Steve Harris for the extra panel. Wait, I forgot. If you listened to the show 2 weeks ago, you know, I did a whole section on international travel for the guy going to Ireland and how to charge your cell phone with 220 volts from other countries. I added a whole incredibly detailed section on water purification and foreign travel. You can, with what I show you, you can be in India or Mexico or wherever and drink the water from the tap with the Harris proven methods I have on prep1234.com. Scroll down and look for the water purification. You will basically have unlimited bottled water for free and under your own control. This works very good. There's new stuff on the market. It's 1/5 the price, and it gives you 100,000 gallons of water. It's really remarkable stuff, so take a look at it. All of my stuff with Jack is listed at Steven1234.com. Thank you guys for the great question. Looking forward to getting some more. Hopefully I'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Hi, Jack. Jason from PA here with a little prepper tip. A lot of people have to get regular prescriptions, and preppers always talk about, you know, how long the meds last. And I know we despise Walmart most of the time, but most of the meds that I've gotten from Walmart have been in vacuum foil sealed individual sheets. So you get your 30 days, but they're all sealed. So if you don't use them, they'll last a lot more being in that vacuum seal than just in a screw cap jar. The other thing is, if you don't have insurance, Walmart's got like a lot of the common basic generics for like $4 or less. So they've pretty much offered that as a service. A lot of people don't realize it, that you can get prescriptions without insurance for like $4. Just a prepper tip and a Google tip.
Let me start out with, I don't hate Walmart. I hate things about Walmart, but I don't hate Walmart as an entity any more than I would hate, let's say, Pfizer Pharmaceutical or Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical that's prescribed the drug that I have to go get filled at a pharmacy somewhere. I think that there's a great tip here, and I think there's also a great way of looking at things here. So, for instance, last night I cooked a chicken, and it was a chicken that I got from dun 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 Walmart. Oh my God, it was Tyson or Purdue. No, actually, it was a far better quality chicken than I can generally get at a place like Albertsons. Albertsons at times will have organic chicken, but a lot of time they won't. And organic isn't necessarily better. It has a lot to do with who you're buying it from. Walmart sells a natural chicken that's pretty much an outdoor-raised pastured bird for about $9 to $10 a bird versus like $4 for one that isn't. They come in a green and white label, and they have the name of the family that produced the chicken on the label. I'll buy that product from Walmart. Is it a 10 as far as poultry goes? No, but I would say this. If Purdue and Tyson is a 2 or a 3, it's like a 5 or a 6. It's double better. So I'll reward Walmart for providing that product by purchasing it from them. If I'm going to buy a name brand product, it doesn't really matter who I buy it from, so I buy it from whatever's most convenient and affordable for me. Usually, at this point, that's Amazon.com, not Walmart, because I don't have to leave my house, and Amazon ships it to my home. But this villainization of companies that pay people minimum wage and stuff kind of dovetails into the last conversation we had about this a little bit, but here's how I feel about this. The thing I hate the most about Walmart is the level of service I get when I am there. How long I wait in line. How lethargic some of the people at the checkout counters are. How incompetent many of the employees are. And do you know what that means? It's a damn good thing for them that Walmart has run a store so efficiently that it can afford to have them as incompetent people working for them. Now, don't be mad at me if you work for Walmart. There's a lot of really great people that work for Walmart. And many of them work their way up and make pretty good livings. Not outstanding, amazing livings, but pretty good livings working for Walmart. And there's some people there that, you know, they're just lucky they have a job. And we as society are lucky they have a job, too. Walmart employs over 1.5 million people. 1.5 million. I would bet you at least 30% of them, 500,000 of those people are the people I'm talking about. At least that's 500,000 people that we're not paying for, that have a job, that have shitty benefits, but they have benefits. And they have an opportunity to do more. And if you work for Walmart and you feel like you're not paid enough and you're not appreciated and there's no opportunity for the future, you have two choices. You can either get your shit together so that you can create an opportunity for yourself within Walmart, or you can get your shit together at a higher level so you can go work for someone else. It amazes me to hear the arguments about the minimum wage thing and benefits and all, and then hear somebody bring up a company like, well, look at Chick-fil-A. They pay their people better. Yes, and they have better people. They have better people. Go to any Chick-fil-A and go to any McDonald's. And 99 times out of 100, it will blow you away the difference in the quality of service, the speed of service, the quality of food, etc. I've seen the exceptions. There's a Walmart, or not a Walmart, a McDonald's somewhere out in the, like near Tyler, Paris, somewhere out there, right off of 30. I can't remember exactly where. But we stopped there a couple times during our trips to Hot Springs and back when we used to have a place up there, especially before I was eating better. And I have to tell you, like, if you went there in the morning and got a chicken biscuit, I'm sure it was factory chicken, but it was juicy, it was crisp, the bun was soft, the people were on the ball, they knew what they were doing, they were giving you excellent service. I bet you they don't make minimum wage at that one. So, What minimum wage does is create a stratification for the bottom performing employees, and some companies figure out how to run efficiently enough to employ those people. Thank God. And anybody that can afford to pay a little bit more, that wants a little bit better of an employee, gets their pick of the next level up. And it's why you see a complete difference in the quality of employee inside a Costco versus a Walmart. But if you jack up the minimum wage to what Costco pays, you'll equalize everything back out, and Costco will end up paying more in the end. And it'll cost more to do business there, and everything will equalize. Just like us. So I don't give a damn that Walmart's open on Christmas Day. If you don't want to support them in that decision, don't go there on Christmas Day. And you know what? If nobody did, they'd be closed. But they're not closed, are they? Well, they make their employees work on Christmas Day. Then don't work there. If you don't like Walmart, don't shop there, don't work there. But don't villainize a company that's employing a lot of people that I have to say I really don't think would have a job anywhere else. Really don't. I have seen some of the most, what's the word, borderline competent at holding a job people employed by that company. Like, they are competent enough to hold a job, but just barely. And if that offends you because you work there and you're competent, again, I know the exceptions exist, but if that offends you and you work there and you know you're competent, how many of the people that work next to you do you know are the people I'm talking about? How many of them? How many do you look at and think, shh? How many of them are you disgusted that they're paid anything close to what you are because you know you do so much more? Well, I've got good news for you. Find your path up or find your path out, because you're better than the basis there. And that means you can do better for yourself. Anyway, I don't hate Walmart. Good tip. If I can get prescription medications for $4 at Walmart versus $20 at, let's say, CVS, guess where I'm going if I need them. Let's take another call.
Hi, Jack. Clinton in Northwest Ohio. My question for you is this. How do you make venison bone broth without getting that nasty venison taste? the nasty phase I'm talking about is I took a leg, the bones, and didn't get all the cartilage off it. I don't know if there's a trick to that or what the deal is, but when you don't trim off all the fat in the deer, you get that just bad taste. And that's what happened when I tried boiling the bones. My wife about threw me out of the house. It was a unpleasant experience that lingered for the rest of the evening through the smell. So if you know of any tricks to get rid of that awful taste so we can enjoy the whole deer, I'd appreciate it. Thanks. Bye.
I'm going to bet through my clairvoyance, even though you didn't provide me with the information, though you sort of did, that you did two things definitively incorrect in the production of bone broth for medicine. The first one is that you did not roast the bones before you made the bone broth. A lot of people make this mistake, and you can make some pretty nasty stuff out of beef bones, etc., by doing the same thing. They take the bones completely raw, they throw them in the pot, they turn the heat on. This does not result in a good quality bone broth. It does not result in the rich flavors. It doesn't result in a darkened broth that has really great taste, etc. It usually doesn't result into a really bad smell, but you can get some more smell out of it. And some of the other problems you're having are probably not specifically blamed on by this, but the first thing to do when you're making bone broth is take your bones with little bits of meat and everything on them and put them in a roasting pan and put them in the oven and roast them till they're nice and dark brown. A good temperature to do this at is about 350 degrees. Most things can be roasted for about 30 to 45 minutes. Some larger bones and all, you'll do better to roast for more like close to an hour. I do this with chicken. I do this with duck, leftover duck. I do this with everything. Most of the time with chicken and duck, I've already cooked it, and then I'm putting the bones in of the leftovers to make broth with. But that is how you make a bone broth first, is we roast the bones. I'm betting you didn't. Then here's the other thing you don't do when you make bone broth. You don't boil it. You simmer it. And what a lot of people do is they take their bones and they figure, well, it can't burn because the whole thing's full of water. They chunk those raw bones in there and they turn the heat up and they get it to a fast rolling boil, and maybe they back it down a little bit, but bubble, 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 bubble. And what should be a nice, clear, beautiful broth in the end is hazy and cloudy, and all types of things happen and reactions happen, and you don't get the results you're looking for. So that is probably a big part, too, of conveying, let's say, some of the stink that results in boiling a raw bone product without roasting it, and then boiling at highly intensive, rapid boiling conditions to where it's effervescing all of the stuff from the cartilage and the marrow, etc. So if you want to do this right, roast your bones, add a little apple cider vinegar to your water, bring it to a boil. A watch pot does boil. You just have to watch for a while. As it starts to boil, back it down. And you want to simmer bone stock to where it barely bubbles, where it's just simmering so. And if you start to see it bubble, 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 even a light roll, you got to back it down. You got to back it down. You want a simmer. You want to be holding that water right at the edge of where it boils a little bit and stops, and boils a little bit and stops, and it simmers and it steams, and that's perfect. And if you do that, you'll probably get a much better result. Now, there is another, well, maybe thing here. Sometimes people say that nasty venison taste. Well, you don't like deer. I can't help you. If you don't like the way deer taste, if you want something to be like a store-bought, commoditized piece of meat that has absolutely no flavor and tastes like cardboard, and then you're going to try to do that with a naturally raised animal, it's not going to work. Since it sounds like you eat deer meat, I don't think that's the problem here. But I'm guessing raw bones boiled at high velocity, there's your problem. Try it and let me know. And if I'm not right, let me know what you did do, and I'll try to help you from there. Let's take another one.
Hey, Jack, simple question. Thoughts on Hillary running for president now that she actually announced? And what I mean is, you think she's going to win? What do you see for those next 8 years? Thanks.
Yeah, I have to tell you, like, Do I get a warm, fuzzy feeling thinking about the prospect of President Hillary Clinton? No. Some people know where that's from. Oh, no. Anyway, no. Do I think it's likely in our future? No. Do I think it would really be the catastrophic disaster that everybody seems to think that it is? I think it would be a lot like the Obama administration and the Clinton administration, which I'm completely dissatisfied with, but the world didn't end. I mean, all of the things that were forecasted for gloom and doom, and it's all over now with Barack Obama. Yeah. You got the health care. And let me tell you, you would have gotten some version of it out of both Republican nominees because the people in charge of the main event had decided it was time to do it to you. That's the reality. See, I really do look at the politics in this country as being like WWE wrestling, okay? And if I was to do that, and in spite of the fact of how you feel thinking about Hillary Clinton in tights, spandex. But if we had her as a WWE wrestler, she's like the person that will never be the champion, right? Even though the champion's predetermined. They just will never give her that. But she is like the guy in wrestling that looks the part enough to put in the championship match that he's never going to win. To date myself, you're going back to Hulk Hogan dropping the big leg on the Iron Sheik for the 400th time in a row. Choreographed. Okay? So I don't think you're going to see a Hillary Clinton presidency. In fact, I will tell you this. If Hillary Clinton becomes the Democratic nominee for president, it will be the same as John McCain being the Republican nominee for president in the first election against Barack Obama. It was the other side basically just saying, we don't want it this time. It's not our turn. McCain and Romney were white flags of surrender. Hillary Clinton would be a white flag of surrender. There is, and if you think about it this way, like it's almost designed to be this way because who else do the Democrats have right now? Elizabeth Warren? Like, the only reason she even exists there is because she's another woman. Joe Biden? This guy was retreaded so many times, the only reason he ever stepped foot in the White House is because he was picked to be a running mate that was seen as a non-threat. Right? Any president is at least a little bit concerned that, you know, in that first re-election cycle, the vice president might go off the reservation and say, hey, I want your job. I'm going to challenge you for our own party's nomination. Right? That was part of why Hillary Clinton didn't get that job. And you also will need a guy that'll basically shut up and do what he's told. And if he says anything stupid, it'll stick to him instead of you. That's Joe Biden. I mean, if you've ever seen Jeff Dunham, he's the Walter puppet. He looks like him and he's him, right? He says dumb shit, but at least it's funny, right? And I mean, so Biden is not a viable candidate, and there's been nothing done during this presidency to kind of sell him to the American people as being a valid next president. Only other people that they're even including in polls against Clinton are people like Bernie Sanders. He's a socialist, at least he's honest, which means he has no potential to ever be nominated for president. Webb and O'Malley are thrown around with like 1%. So Hillary has this commanding lead for the nomination. And it's like the Democrats have done nothing to groom anybody to compete with her. She's like guaranteed, right? Unless something changes. So this is how you know you're not getting a Democrat president. Unless a true challenger rises on the Democrat side, you're not getting it. Now, the only person that I think that has any credible possibility of getting the nomination on the Republican side that could possibly in any world lose to Hillary Clinton is, you guessed it, Jeb Bush. And I don't think that's happening either. Right now, I think that the most likely guy that you're going to see rise up on the Republican side isn't Ted Cruz. You know, it isn't Rand Paul. It's probably someone who's gotten very little talking about up till now, and it's Scott Walker out of Wisconsin. He's probably your Republican strongman. He's right now, out of all the people that have the potential to be sold to the American people, he's the one with the least sticky, nasty shit to him. He's very well liked by the Republican rhinos. He's very well liked by the actual Republican conservatives. The people that hate him never vote Republican anyway. So he's disliked by like teachers unions and all. If you're on the Republican side of things, you're not even looking at that demographic for votes. Right? He's not going to carry the states that always go Democrat, and he's not going to lose any of the states that always go Republican, and he has a real good chance to get the swing states. So what you have to understand is I use the WWE analogy a lot, but in this competition, it really is, who does the crowd cheer louder for? So it's also in a way more like boxing than wrestling. So who is the heavyweight champion of the world right now in boxing? I don't know. I don't pay attention. I think MMA has really caused a lot of people to not pay attention, but it's somebody. There's somebody that's there. I guarantee you that I could probably find in gyms across Texas 20 guys that can beat his ass, whoever he is. Don't even care who he is. Don't care. Guys that are so big and so tough that I don't care how much this guy sticks and moves or whatever, they're going to eventually get a hold of him and give him one club to the face, and he's out. And he just can't do enough damage to these people because of their size. The heavyweight champion of the world, averaging around 220 pounds, makes no sense. Makes no sense at all. It's designed as theater, but the fight is real. This is actually more like presidential politics. It's designed as theater, but trust me, both sides want to win, but sometimes the other side knows they're not winning, and they know they're just playing along. Sometimes it's close, and both criminals think, I can be the one to win, right? But in the end, it's pretty well determined who's going to win, and it's certainly determined who can win. So, the only way this even comes to a point where you go, I don't know who's going to win, is if you get a Bush-Clinton thing. And I don't think the country is going to let that happen. I think there's so many people on the right that just don't ever want to hear the word Bush again, that there's no way Jeb Bush wins the nomination. I don't care what polls say. You can make a poll say anything you want based on which slice you choose to phone and who's talking about what any given time. I don't think you get a Bush. I don't think you get a Paul. I think out of all the psychopaths running for president in the next 2 years, he's probably the lowest level psychopath. He's probably the guy that really wants to do the best that he can. And I don't think he's his dad. I don't think he's anywhere cut to the level of his dad, but I think he's probably better than everybody else. So that means there's no chance. There's no chance, and he doesn't fit the model for the final battle that the people in power want. Now, here's what you're going to have for a president in 2016. Someone beholden to special interest groups. If you look at the people donating money to Hillary Clinton, it's the same people that donated money to Mitt Romney in the last election. The same people. And whoever kind of works their way out of the Republican side will be the same. But if I had, see, right now I'm not sure. I don't know who your guy on the Republican side is yet. But if I had to name the guy, it would be Scott Walker. I don't think Perry can come back from the catastrophic screw up of the last debates. He's talking about announcing. I see people like going, I also see this playing out this way. In the end, America's going to once again want hope and change. They just won't call it this time. But what they're going to want is something new, a new face, a new name. Scott Walker's new to people. They don't know him. Rand Paul, I've seen people already going, Ron has ruined Rand's opportunities because... No, Rand Paul wouldn't exist without Ron Paul. I don't mean like because Ron sired him as a child. I mean, Rand Paul would not be holding the office of dog catcher if it wasn't for his father with an incredible record of liberty for 30 years. Rand Paul only is in office because of Ron's legacy, period. So, but there's no way Rand gets there. Ted Cruz, give me a break. No. And it's not even that I don't like the guy. I mean, I don't. But Marco Rubio, these two guys don't. These two guys might end up being candidates for VP. Something like Walker Rubio. Walker Rubio has more marketing ring to it. Walker Rubio 2016. If I had to pair them together right now, that's what I'm seeing there. Walker Rubio. And I think those are your next two, that's your president and vice president. Unless, and what I've been saying the whole time when people say, well, who's it going to be if it's all predetermined? There is still time for a Bill Clinton moment. When Bill Clinton came into the election against George Sr., no one even considered him at the very beginning. At the beginning of like the Democrat primaries and all, nobody was like, it's probably going to be Bill Clinton. There's still time for the powers that be to put a player's piece, a chess piece in play that someone we haven't talked about yet. The reason I'm leaning toward Walker, he kind of is. They gave him enough, you know, sensationalism around the whole fighting the teachers union thing. The right likes that. He's from a Midwestern state, Wisconsin, you know, North Midwest. He's probably your next president. We'll see. We'll see if Jack was right or not. And I reserve the right to change that opinion, but no Hillary Clinton for president. I think she's categorically unelectable. And that if she's nominated, it is a white flag from the Democrats going, hand off, we don't want it this time. We're going to swing the next midterm election and take the House back. That's our plan. Whether they do it or not, we'll see. But that's the pendulum has reached an apex, and it's now swinging back the other way. And the powers that be know that that creates the illusion that you are in control and that your vote really matters, and that makes you an obedient little serf. So it's time to let you have a new illusion. Let's take another one.
Hey, Jack. This is Sarah from Michigan. What's the best way to start a new garden space in a backyard? It's just grass. Not sure if we should use a tarp to cover the grass and kill it, or if we should cover it in soaked cardboard. We have until the middle of May. Also, me and my husband have been listening to you since 2010. Thanks. Love the show.
If you were going to plant this thing 6 months from now, I would just say to sheet mulch it and maybe tarp it for a bit to kill off a lot of the grass and all. But this time of year, with the grass reaching kind of its peak of vigor, and you probably have rhizomial grasses like Bermudas or things like that. You know, it's not just your annual grasses you're dealing with. That it's going to probably be best to dig the sod and at least turn it over to disrupt the grass from its growth cycle and to prevent it from emerging through whatever you mulch with. So I'm going to recommend digging and turning the sod and then building up from there, whether it's with bordered raised beds or just with you know, kind of hilled up raised beds. And I'm also going to recommend that at this time of year you use an organic herbicide. It sounds evil. It'll cost you about 80 cents a gallon, white vinegar. And I'm going to recommend that you spray the grass with white vinegar. And you can do that either with a sprayer or you can use it in a watering can and actually just sprinkle the area pure, full-on white vinegar. And that you do that before you turn the grass. And then after you turn it and you've got all the roots up, you hit it again. And in a day, any real effect of that vinegar will be gone. And it won't affect anything else, but it'll put the beat down on the grass for you. And then I would do a thick sheet mulching, a layer of compost and or topsoil. Well, first I would probably do like a layer of straw, then a layer of compost and topsoil, and then maybe do the same thing again, another like a lasagna layer of that, and you know, a good quality either compost or topsoil base mix on your last layer. And I would probably mulch then with wood chips. And I would probably also hit that right after you're done with a liquid molasses fertilizer to help feed micros and get things established. And then understand, since you're probably bringing those inputs in, even though there's compost there, if you're using commercial compost, a lot of times it's pretty biologically lifeless. It's not got a lot of microorganism activity and things going on like that. And it's going to take a while for the system to establish itself. So it's not that there's not nitrogen, there's not potassium, there's not phosphorus there, but the bioavailability is going to have a lag while the life in the soil kind of comes up and wakes up and starts figuring stuff out, and roots start coming down, and little things start chewing on things, and little creatures eat other little creatures and crap them out, and plants start making exudates and all. So there's this time when you're first putting your seeds in and your seedlings in where you might have kind of like this weak growth. And it's okay to fertilize for that. And an organic fertilizer, like a blood and bone, would be a really great addition. Maybe a little bit of organic phosphorus of some sort as well to get things going. And then I think you can move to just adding compost and adding mulches and not really using a lot of supporting organic fertilizers, but especially getting it off the ground. You're going to want to do that. And this is something that people in northern climates should understand. You're going to have that same lag every single year when the soil's still cold. It's workable. You can plant in it. The danger of frost is past. You can put your plants out, but you put them out there and you just kind of like, right? Either you need to warm your soil artificially through row covers or something like that to get that biology going, or you need to supplement the fertilization in the early growth stages until the biology of the soil kind of like wakes up and starts kicking ass. Now, the good news for you is when it happens in the northern climate, it happens hard. Like that biology, because it's a short growing season, so all the plants, all of the soil arthropods, etc., all are like, okay, it's time to go, let's go. So as soon as they do wake up, they wake. That's why the Northeast goes from like brown 1 minute to bright green the next. It's because it's like a hard-working man waking up and charging off to work at 5 o'clock in the morning. In the South, we have more of like the lazy teenager on a Saturday. It's like, oh, God, I got to get... It's because the growing season's so long that the natural impetus for fast isn't there the way it is in the North. So we don't usually have our soils completely go to sleep, but we don't have that supercharged kick on when it happens. It's more level and mundane, and it actually, we have two pauses down here. We have our midwinter pause, and we have our midsummer pause. It actually gets too hot. So the northern climates, which if you're going to be another month before you plant, probably you're edging toward that. You're going to have that issue every year with your garden. Again, if you were doing this, it was like October and you're getting ready for spring, I would just tell you sheet mulch it and tarp it and plant in the spring. But a month away, if you don't do something to disrupt that grass growth cycle, you're going to be pulling an awful lot of grass by June. You really are. So you need to get in there and disrupt that grass cycle. I'll also tell you this. I don't hate tillers. I wouldn't buy one if you're only going to put this one garden in one time, but you could borrow one. And tilling once, and again, I'd hit it with the vinegar, doesn't bother me. Okay? I believe in no-till systems. That doesn't mean never-till systems. So if you're going to till it again next year and next year and next year, I'm not about that. But tilling it to break the sod and then getting in there and double digging it and knocking back that grass and then mulching on top of it, yes, the tiller will compact the subsoil some, but everything you're going to do from that point on is going to open it back up and aerate it, et cetera. And if you really wanted to do it right, if you were using a tiller, you'd go in there, you'd till it, you'd break up the sod, and come in with something like a broad fork and go down below where you tilled and just put the fork in and rock it back and forth and open up that subsoil that you've packed down a little bit and then do your mulching on top of that. And you'll probably have outstanding results if you do that. So that's what I would do this time of year. Let's take another one.
Hey, Jack. This is Ben in Denver. Okay, my question is, what are the beneficial aspects, if any, to having naturally occurring moss growing in your yard?
and how should I go about preserving it or encouraging it? Details are, it's about 15 by 15 foot section on the south side of my yard where there are two upright junipers that are about 25 feet tall. It's one of the last places where snow melts during the winter, I've noticed. I'm thinking it's something about the trees that are creating the kind of suitable environment for the moss to grow. I'm not really sure on that, though. Also, it's right along where the ditch lateral comes through that feeds the neighborhood. For a long time, it was an open ground ditch, which I'm sure kind of contributed to, like, high moisture levels, and I'm thinking that might be part of it. It has since been changed within about 10 years ago to a piped ditch, but the moss still seems to be kind of surviving. It's pretty cool to have growing. I'd like to possibly encourage it and, possibly, you know, if not, save the population I have going now at least. I believe it's either cushion moss or sheet moss from what I've looked up. I'm pretty sure it's sheet moss. It's pretty, really dark and very low growing. So, I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on what you might do, something like that, to kind of encourage it and maybe do something cool with it. And, thanks for the show and everything you do, and we'll talk to you later.
Well, the biggest benefit to moss growing in that type of environment is it's acting as a ground cover. It's protecting the soil. It's preventing erosion. It's holding in moisture, and it looks nice. So those are the benefits. It doesn't do a whole lot else for you. The odds are, if it's growing there all on its own, you don't really have to do much else. The only thing you could do to have a problem would be to specifically alter the environment in a way that discouraged it or damaged it, and that would be by opening it up and letting too much light in. If you have these big juniper trees and you have this kind of area that stays, so here's what I know about the area from what you told me. It stays colder there than it does everywhere else. Okay, and it's shaded. So it's cool and it's shaded and it's moist. Moss grows there. So you don't really have to do anything. Now, does it present any opportunities for other things? About the only thing I can tell you is one of our big things when I was a kid in Pennsylvania was picking blueberries and huckleberries. And there were some edge areas on the backside of the mountain called Pine Hill that we picked most of our blueberries on where there were these moss patches like that. And it was very shaded, but then there were roads, and the roads opened up so there was solar exposure. And the blueberries, instead of out in the more of the field-like environments where we picked the majority of them in this area, grew right on the edge. And their roots, you could tell, would extend underneath the moss. And there were also a lot of conifers in this environment, so there was acidity, which the blueberries loved. And the blueberries that grew where the moss grew were the plumpest, juiciest, and sweetest blueberries of all the blueberries we picked. So it would seem that other berries might work with that, like raspberry or blackberry or what have you, the same way. Or since it's shady, another thing that you might be able to work into that design would be currants or maybe some sort of I wouldn't go with a bush cherry. I'm learning right now that even here they can have too much shade. But a currant would be another planting that you could put on the edges where their roots would get underneath that moss. It's also great habitat for your soil life and organisms and stuff, but there's not a lot to be done except you don't want to open it up, and if you get into dry periods, throwing a little moisture its way would kind of help it through that dry period. But basically what you have is a little forest alcove. That is a very foresty thing, and it has a great sense of place to have that, you know, type of thing growing on your property, to feel that there's a little cove of wilderness there. So I think it's very cool. Ain't really good for eating. It doesn't tell you which way is north, contrary to what a lot of people believe, because if you're on the north-facing slope of a hill, it tends to grow all over the place. But anyway, it does provide that serenity. It does provide that ground cover. It does provide that aesthetic. And I can say that if you can find something that you can plant in the area that either can deal with the shade or gets enough sun, my experience has been that anything with roots underneath there tends to do very, very well. And I bet you it's not just the moisture and this natural mulch-like. I bet you there's a lot of soil-organism interactions going on in that environment. The other thing I would say is it's probably, if you want to do any kind of mushroom cultivation, that area itself, not necessarily on top of the moss, but in that area, it's going to be definitely a good place for mushroom cultivation. It might be an area where just on the peripheral edges would be a good place to sink some mushroom logs. So get your post hole digger out, drop some logs in, inoculate them right on the edges of that moss. It's probably a great place for mushroom cultivation. That's about all I can pull out of this one for you. But thanks for the call. It was a kind of a good, lighthearted one for the end of the show. Hope everybody enjoyed today's show. We ourselves are in the path of some severe thunderstorms this coming day and tomorrow specifically. Much of the rest of the country, you are as well. And then many of you further east of us are going into Sunday. Keep your powder dry. Pay attention to what's going on. This is not a high outlook for tornadoes in this particular set of storms. The Torcon rating from the Weather Channel is like 2 to 3 in most of the threatened areas, including here. But I've seen some of the worst tornadoes during those types of low-level ratings. For those not familiar with Torcon, it represents a percentage of a tornado occurring within 50 miles of any given area. So a 2 is a 20% chance of a tornado within 50 miles of where you are if you're in the area where it's forecasted for. So it's still rather significant, and it has no bearing on how intense or large or threatening those storms would be. So there's a lot going on right now. It is springtime. The next 2.5 months are where the peak of this type of weather is. Also, many of you in the southeastern United States, you've had a lot of rain. More is coming with these storms. Potential for flooding and flash flooding. Please pay attention to those risks as well. Otherwise, have a great weekend. Look after each other, look after yourselves, look after your community, look after your family. And with that, this has been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. Like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Nobody up there cares, they're living for today. Revolution is you.